Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Jay Richards with the Discovery Institute here in Seattle, and my guest today is Professor John Lennox. Professor Lennox is a professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford and a fellow in mathematics and the philosophy of science at Green Templeton College. You may have heard of him before. You may have even seen him on YouTube. He's debated famous atheists like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and lived to tell about it, and has lectured at many universities around the world. In fact, he's here in Seattle with us for several days, giving some lectures in the area. Professor Lennox, it's great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I wanted to talk about your recent book on Stephen Hawking. Many of the listeners will know that Hawking had a book out last year called The Grand Design. I guess someone told him the word design sells books. And if you read the book, this is sort of his latest thinking on these questions in cosmology, especially as they relate to theology. And in fact, I think every English-speaking newspaper in the world reported on this book and some of the sort of things that he said, some great sort of sound bites. But you've written this little book responding to Hawking called God and Stephen Hawking, Whose Design Is It Anyway? And I enjoyed this book. It's a small book. It, in my opinion, says all of the main things that need to be said in response to Hawking. But what made you decide to write the book?
Well, first of all, I was invited to write an op-ed piece for one of the major English daily newspapers on this. And when I started, I just kept writing. And it turned into a book once I'd seen what Hawking was actually saying.
The famous quote that perhaps everyone has heard is this statement along the lines of, because there are laws such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. In fact, I saw an LA Times reporter that responded to this by saying, well, this is something that must be believed but not understood.
Well, I think I would put it more strongly than that. I would say that it can't be understood because it's self-contradictory. And it was that actual statement that amazed me when you put it together with his initial page one statement that philosophy is dead.
Right.
And then he and his co-author continue to write a book on philosophy and prove, I'm afraid, that as far as they're concerned, philosophy very much is dead. But that statement was incredible. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. The first obvious thing to say about it is, well, a law of gravity isn't nothing.
Right.
And a law of gravity without gravity would be meaningless. So that's the first self-contradiction.
Yeah.
The second is that the universe will create itself. If I say X creates Y, what I mean in English is that I presuppose the existence of X to explain the existence of Y.
Mm-hmm.
So if I say X creates X, then I'm presupposing the existence of X to explain the existence of X. And what that shows to me is that if you put X equal to the universe, it shows that nonsense remains nonsense, even if famous scientists talk it.
Well, this is the dilemma of not studying perhaps any philosophy. I'll say that as a philosopher. Of course, Hawking, at the very beginning of his book, is violating one of the sort of basic rules of reasoning, that from nothing, nothing comes. And I'm actually glad that he said philosophy is dead at the beginning of the book, because it brought a lot of philosophers out of the woodwork who have helped dismantle.
Oh, it has done, particularly on the continent, particularly in the German-speaking world. But Hawking was interviewed more recently by the Guardian newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And he made this statement that heaven is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. I don't know whether you've come across this. And I was asked to respond to it. And I said, well, if you want a one-liner at that level, then atheism is a fairy story for people afraid of the light.
That's gold. Yeah, the perfect sort of sound bites. It's funny because I remember when you wrote the piece, was it in the Telegraph?
It was in the Daily Mail.
In the Daily Mail, that's right, because I was writing a piece at the same time and found it and quoted you in an article here in the United States in The American on some of the same subjects. It's really an astonishing thing because most people, if they said, well, the universe creates itself from nothing, the average person would think, huh, that doesn't make any sense. But there's something about the stature or the aura around Stephen Hawking that reasonable people give him a free pass. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that Stephen Hawking, clearly, I mean, he's arguably the most famous living scientist. He is a genius. Mm-hmm. I was at Cambridge just a bit behind him. I remember him walking around in Cambridge in those early days. And I think the trouble is, and to be fair, it applies to me as well, we've got to be careful as scientists when we go outside our own field. Mm. And I just think that Hawking has not checked with philosophers. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that if a person is a famous scientist, particularly, science has such a cultural authority at the moment that they think that every statement of a scientist is a statement of science, and it very frequently isn't. And I think that's where we need to be extremely careful.
Absolutely. I mean, this is for discerning and informed citizens, the task of distinguishing the philosophy that is often sewn in with the content of science and distinguishing one from the other. It's a hard task, and a lot of non-scientists feel incompetent to do that.
Yes, and feel intimidated about it. I think my chief objection, though, to what Hawking and Dawkins and co. are doing is this false alternative, offering people a choice between God and science. Mm. Now, that seems to be a mistake, but it comes from the fact that they have assumed that God is a God of the gaps. Mm-hmm. So the more science increases, the less space there is for God to dwell. Right. And if you think of God as that, then of course you'll say, people, you have to choose between God and science.
Sure.
But that certainly isn't the Christian view. In fact, it isn't the view of any sensible person that I've ever met.
Right.
God is the God of the whole show. And to offer people a choice between God and science as explanation is like offering people a choice between Henry Ford and mechanical engineering as an explanation for a Ford motor car.
Yeah, absolutely.
In order to explain it completely, you need both an explanation in terms of science, law, mechanism, and in terms of agency, Henry Ford. And it's the same with God and the universe. And that seems to me to be so elementary. And yet, because of the immense scientific prestige, people feel, well, we've got to choose between God and science. And of course you don't.
Well, you don't. And it's funny because it's really a fairly recent innovation in science. I mean, you mentioned Isaac Newton, who, of course, was perfectly happy to make both mechanistic and mathematical explanations, and nevertheless to infer back to a first cause, which he says is most decidedly not a mechanism. That's one of the greatest scientists of all time, had no problem doing this.
Well, it's even stronger than that, I think. It was the belief in God and a designer behind nature that actually was the motor that drove the rise of science in the first place. And I feel it's very important to remind people of that bit of history because it is so important.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny because if you open up an astronomy textbook, for instance, you'll usually get a chapter on the supposed history of science. And in fact, I've often said that the sort of materialist ideology that some people adopt in science, people like Richard Dawkins, are dependent very much on this materialist rewriting of the history of science. And so in some ways, the best way, to inoculate people against these bad ideas is to just inform them of the...
Oh, it is indeed. And also perhaps to inform them of Joseph Needham's attempt to understand the lack of modern science as we know it in the Chinese culture, because Needham was a chemist and an expert on China, but he was also a Marxist. Mm. And he tried to explain the difference. Why is there science in the West and why is there no science as distinct from technology in China, effectively? Mm-hmm. And in the end, he came to the conclusion, as a Marxist, that the only difference he could detect was the Chinese did not have the unifying concept of a creator who created the universe according to a particular design and plan. And that, he said, as a Marxist. So the negative side is interesting as well.
That's wonderful to have that from Needham. No one would accuse him of being a Christian propagandist.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
You mentioned, of course, the idea of a multiverse. I mean, it's funny because Hawking's quote about universe creating itself from nothing got most of the play and is probably the most implausible thing he said. But of course, the multiverse is sort of now the most popular way of getting around some telltale evidence of so-called fine-tuning. And what do you think of this multiverse idea?
Well, I suppose I'm a bit biased because I was taught quantum mechanics at Cambridge by Professor Sir John Polkinghorne. And Polkinghorne is extremely skeptical of it. But it's very interesting that Hawking comes across with this as if his M theory connected with multiverses was really the theory of everything that, mm-hmm. that people are looking for. And yet his co-author and equally eminent mathematician, in my opinion, Sir Roger Penrose, thinks he's overreached entirely and feels that this M theory isn't really even a theory. Now, I'm not an expert in these fields, but again, I step back and say that even if multiverse theory is true, again, we have these people facing us with a false alternative, either the multiverse or God. But can't God create more than one universe if he wants to? And philosophers have not been slow in pointing out that there's an illogicality here. But of course, since the other universes aren't accessible to us, it does remain in what I'm tempted to call the mythological realm.
It's at least suspicious. It seems very strange to look at something, some evidence that I would say looks like fine-tuning. It looks fine-tuned, perhaps because it is fine-tuned. And on the basis of that evidence, to appeal to this vast ensemble of other universes just to sort of inflate the resources for chance. It seems quite ad hoc to me.
It does seem very suspiciously ad hoc. And if you add to that the fact that there's no evidence of these and so on. I have a good friend who is a philosopher of physics in Oxford and an atheist. And he actually didn't feel that the fine-tuning argument was affected by the multiverses at all. Because very frequently we're talking about the fine-tuning within this universe, you see. So, you know, I just am not impressed with it. And I still think, and it's very interesting that Hawking spends so much time in his book. He calls it the grand design.
Yes.
Because he's impressed with what very much looked like design. And I think he presents quite a good argument when you take the negative sides that actually it is the result of intelligent causation.
Well, it's an exciting time to be alive, to have access to this evidence.
Oh, absolutely. It's fascinating.
Well, Professor John Lennox, we're talking about your book, God and Stephen Hawking, Whose Design Is It Anyway? Thanks so much for being with
us. It's a pleasure.
For ID the Future, this is Jay Richards at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Thanks for joining us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.